For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and as always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. What's up, Kent?
Hello, Calvin.
How's it going?
It's fine. I just realized as I was going over the guest list today, looking at the topic and looking at the guest list, I am the living embodiment of the Sesame Street song, "Which One of These Things Is Not Like the Others?"
Well, one of our guests is white.
Oh, so it'll be interesting. Well, she's not here.
She's not here yet.
Then
she's
I wouldn't have made that joke.
So you wouldn't have known.
How
could you have known? Currently, she's invisible.
I could have asked.
Anyhow.
I guess, but yes.
Yeah. Anyway, kind of a little giveaway on what we're talking about today. Today we are talking about Black Enough, a conversation about racial identity, which kind of comes out of – this topic kind of comes out of my own background, growing up and being told I wasn't black enough a long time. And then one of my favorite shows right now is Blackish on ABC, and it deals with a guy who's made it out, right? And he's raising his kids, and he feels like they're not getting the experience that he got and the things that made him into the man that he is because of, you know, but he feels like they're losing something by raising them differently than what was instilled in him.
Okay, so refresh my memory on Blackish, and when I say refresh my memory, I mean tell me for the first time because I've never seen an episode.
Okay.
It's standard family sitcom.
Yeah, think of it like a new version. Today's version of The Cosby Show is essentially what this show is.
But the dad is black and the mom
is also black.
Is she half Jewish? Is it some sort of...
She is Diana Ross's daughter.
Oh, is she?
Yes.
Oh, I mean the character. I like the character.
But she's black and white in the show.
Oh, she is. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, but, you know, they've moved into suburbia. They've moved around predominantly white people, and he feels like, I mean, my kids aren't getting the things that made me who I am today. And so there's kind of racial identity questions that come out of that kind of thing. And so we've invited on four panelists to kind of discuss this idea of what does it mean to be black enough? Am I black enough? This conversation around racial identity. And so going to go over our panelists real quick. First, we have, I want to say for the first time on our show, but technically it's the second time on our show, but I didn't record the episode that he was on, unfortunately, because I'm a failure. Mr. Aaron Foley is back and here for the first time for those who are actually listening. Aaron Foley is a lifelong Detroiter, journalist turned city government storyteller and trivia host. My trivia host, in fact. He received his bachelor's from Michigan State University. Aaron has recently stepped into a newly created position of chief storyteller for the city of Detroit, in which he brings the stories of everyday Detroiters to a new citywide platform. Aaron, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
Again.
I don't know.
Let me just jump in and say, because Calvin and I are on the same trivia team, Aaron is very, very popular with the oi polloi among the trivia team, in so much so that on the first time, I think it was over a year ago, but the first time that he had to miss a week and a backup was called in, who, by all accounts, did a fine job. We like Zach, I think, yeah, does it's a fine Zach. Job. One of the team names was "Where the Hell Is Aaron?"
Well, Zach didn't tell me that.
Okay.
Yeah. So next up, we have back on the line, or we'll be here in a moment. A couple people aren't here yet, but Mr. L. Michael Gibson. L. Michael Gibson is an award-winning writer and educator and an art, youth, LGBTQ rights, and public health advocate. Gibson has worked as a consultant and senior administrator on issues focused on HIV/AIDS, LGBTQ advocacy, creative entrepreneurship, adolescent and sexual reproductive health, and community development programming over his 23 years of public service. I won't go over the rest of his vita, but he is from Chicago and now resides here in Detroit, Michigan. We'll say welcome when he gets here in a second. Next up, new to our show, Miss Angelica Pedraza. Did I pronounce that correctly? Okay, good. Angelica and I used to work together, so this is kind of cool. I haven't seen her in a long time, so it's great having you on. Angelica was born and raised in Lansing, Michigan. Her father is Mexican. Her mother is black. She went to International Academy of Design and Technology in Chicago, where she focused on fashion merchandising. Though she is biracial, she identifies more strongly as a black woman. Angelica, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, Michelle Schubert, she is not here yet either. She'll be here in a few moments. A lot of traffic. She lives she is from Traverse City. She is currently residing in Lansing, Michigan. She received her Bachelor of Science in Anthropology from Central Michigan University. Her current research studies the informal social safety nets constructed by single mothers. Michelle has studied social constructs and their history and implications for many years. She believes the systemic suppression of any group of people for any arbitrary reason to be wrong. So Gibson and Michelle will be here in a few moments, but we do have Aaron and Angelica here in the room already. So let's dive right into questions here real quick.
Before we do, I just wanted to clear up the pronunciation. Miss, how do you pronounce your first name?
Angelica.
Eliza. And Peggy.
And that is a reference to...
You know what?
Yes, it's clearly a Hamilton reference.
Okay,
now you did that. Full disclosure, he did that before the show. And I had no point of reference for what he was doing or saying.
I haven't seen Hamilton either. And,
also, just so you know, before they shoot a sitcom, they rehearse it. So it's not totally out of bounds for me to have workshopped the joke
before we go
on the air.
So Aaron Kent mentions Hamilton on almost every single episode. So that will be the Hamilton reference this week. And I didn't even plan it that way, so... It was totally natural, too. It flew naturally. Anyway, we're going to dive right into questions. First half of the show, kind of talking around the idea of what is race. And so the first question is, how would you define the terms race and racial identity? Doesn't have to be a textbook answer or anything like that, but when you hear the words race or racial identity or you hear people talking about it, what are your thoughts and your understandings of what those words and terms mean?
I'll go first. I thought about this question on the way over, and I still couldn't come up with a concrete answer, I guess. But I think race is sort of defined as there are certain characteristics and aspects about humans that aren't invisible, and race is certainly, in my opinion, a visible thing. It's something you can't conceal about yourself. And it's one of those things that was sort of forced upon humans because, although like if you were to look at a color chart or something like that, we all come in different shades, but, it's become so defined that it's not just like a color wheel or a color shading thing. It's how, people are treated, how people are perceived, how people are ranked in society historically and currently. And it's, you know, that's what race is. It's something that is forcibly used to define us when it doesn't always should be. Now, racial identity is something, in my opinion, a little bit different because someone may be of a particular race but may not readily identify with that race. Identity, I think, is something... in some cases, not all cases, where it's something you can choose to identify with or not. But then it gets kind of complicated. It's just like, why are you choosing not to identify this way? Or why are you choosing to identify this way? So racial identity is fluid, I think, is in terms of how people choose to define themselves based on their race. I guess.
Like, for instance, you can be a straight up white lady and be the head of a chapter of the NAACP.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, is that right? Personally, I don't think that's right, but that's where it gets complicated for me as far as racial identity.
See, yeah, and that's interesting because I didn't have any problem with her in that position. We're talking about Rachel Dolezal right now. I didn't have a problem with her in that position.
Yeah.
I had a problem with her identifying as a black person. That was different. But
yeah, definitely. I feel like there's no problem with her being in that position. It's the fact that she couldn't just own that she was a white woman in the position.
Right.
Like, be you, but can
yeah,
you
do you, do you,
do
yeah.
the job, but do you like?
So what about you? I mean, okay, so Angelica, you're biracial again. Your father is Mexican, okay, and your mother is black, and so you kind of have this what I think a lot of people would understand to be like a dual racial identity. But in the bio that I read, you identify more as a black woman. So when you hear the words race and racial identity, how are you conceiving of those?
I kind of think of racial identity as kind of I'm identifying as my race. Like, I'm Mexican and black. It's never a point where I'm like, oh, no, I'm not Mexican. I'm Mexican and black. But I do identify more as a black woman because of, like, my social networks, who I hang out with, some of the things that I enjoy doing. I just identify more with my, like, black side.
Okay.
So when I think of racial identity, I identify as a black woman.
Okay.
So if Michelle, if you had to fill out a census form or something for your driver's license, do you click African American or Latino or?
If I'm not messing around and just like checking something random, then I'll go ahead and check by racial or Mexican.
Oh, okay.
Black. At no point will I just say I'm just black or I'm just Mexican. I'd probably check like Pacific Islander before I just chose black or Mexican. Okay.
So Michelle just walked in the room. Hi, Michelle. Well, thank you so much for being here, driving all the way in from Lansing. So we're asking this first question. How would you define the terms race and racial identity?
Thank you for having me.
No problem.
My background is in anthropology, and anthropologists have a long history of determining what race is. Race right now in our society is based on a 14th century pigmentology, and so it would be skin color. It's a social construct. It doesn't have any biological standing, but it has a deep, deep effect on so many people. And so it's to me, it's a quagmire of something that is made up in our head but has very real implications.
Okay. Yeah, I think that there's it's kind of interesting. Angelica, you were saying that you identify more as a black woman, and Michelle, you're saying it's more a social construct, and I think that there's this pressure, and we'll get to this a little bit later in the show, the things that we do to ourselves based in and around race. Like, for instance, when I was in college, I went to a predominantly white college. It was a small Christian college, and most Christian colleges in the United States tend to be predominantly white and conservative, and so I'd go to the cafeteria, and they'd be serving, like, fried chicken. I like fried chicken. It's delicious. But there's the stereotype that black people like fried chicken, right? We're genetically predisposed towards it. And it was interesting that I couldn't enjoy something that a lot of people enjoy because of this racial connotation that comes with it. And so it's kind of one of those. But there's also a pressure to like certain things as a black person that I just don't like. As well, historically, we were given things like ham hocks and chitlins and pig's feet and things like that. The term "high off the hog" comes from the slave owners. They would eat, you know, the good meat off the back of the pig, and then we would eat the bottom stuff, what was left over. And I feel like there was pressure for me growing up to like this absolutely disgusting food. It was kind of like a codified, kind of a codified thing in terms of racial identity. But for me, when I think about race, Michelle, like you, I think it's a social construct. I understand it's a social construct. I've studied some of the sociological research, you know, on this stuff, and you know, when it was used against us after Bacon's Rebellion. We'll talk about that when we get to question four. But the idea of racial identity for sure is something that I've thought a lot about, and sometimes I think people have – when I think about racial identity, it's not necessarily – always what I think about myself. sometimes it's what other people think for me. And again, you know, you have to like this because you're black. Well, you know, I happen to be allergic to watermelon, right? I happen to be allergic to melon, period. And I've been told, you're not a good black person. Yo, come on, Calvin, you like watermelon, it's crazy. So there's this pressure for me to like things, things that are assigned to me because of my race. My likes, my dislikes, my skills, my lack of skills, my sexual ability, my, you know, whatever is all ascribed to this racial identity. And it's normally from the outside more so than from myself. And now it's not that I don't, maybe it's not that I'm not a good dancer. I am a good dancer, but
I brought the bell over. So every time you say something self-aggrandizing, I'm going to,
okay,
hit the bell. And I brought it over when you said sexual prowess, because I thought,
but I didn't brag on my sexual prowess.
Okay.
And I'm not going to, that's not the place for it.
Okay. Sure. No, I wouldn't.
But, either way, thank you. If I could turn red, I would. So I find when I'm thinking about racial identity, it's not necessarily things that I think of myself, but more about outside perceptions of who I am and what I ought to be based on my skin color.
Was unprepared. Pointed at me real quick.
There you go.
So let's go around the table and talk about when you first became aware of your own racial identity. I'll start immediately upon birth.
Upon birth?
No. I'll tell you what. The first time, and this is so early, this isn't when I became aware of my racial identity, but I am told this is the first time race ever entered my life, was I was 3 years old and my parents were moving out of the house into which I was born and into a new house, which was new construction. And we were going to check it out along the way a couple of weeks before moving in, and there was a workman there laying carpet, you know, stapling down the carpet. And I had never seen anyone who looked like him before. So at 3 years old, I said, why does he have a dirty face? And so I don't remember that, but that is the apparently the first time I ever saw somebody who didn't look like me.
Interesting. Wow.
Where did you grow up?
The first 3 years in Southfield and then after that in Royal Oak.
Yeah, I had that happen to me. I was working my first job at AMC Wood 6 Movie Theater in Grosse Pointe Woods, Michigan. Mm-hmm. So I should tell you a little bit about Grosse Pointe. But this kid came up to me, and he had to be six. And he pulled on my uniform. He said, Mister, why is your skin so dark like that? And his parents
six
came,
years old?
Six. And his parents came up behind him and was like, oh, my God, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I'm like, yeah, your kid's six.
That's pretty late.
Your kid should have at least seen him on Sesame Street by now. I mean, what color is Gordon? I mean, those kinds of things.
You know, that's true. When I was three, I'd seen Sesame Street. I don't know why. I knew Gordon.
But it is kind of interesting, though, because I think I saw a story the other day about a kid who, a little white boy in elementary school, who cut his hair bald so that his teacher wouldn't be able to tell him and his best friend apart. And he and his best friend was black.
Uh-huh.
So there was like no concept of racial difference. I love that story.
Like a fade.
Yeah. they look alike in the haircut, but they didn't look alike.
Did you ever see a movie, I don't know, 10, 12, going on 20 years ago, probably. I've lost the thread of where it's called Losing Isaiah.
Yes.
I did not see Losing Isaiah.
That movie's
go on.
I won't say it's hilarious, but like
I remember very little about it.
I mean, it's hilarious in the fact that like it's kind of hilariously overdramatic.
It is very
point.
Yes.
Like, but the actual movie is about Halle Berry and Jessica Lange. So Halle Berry is a crack addict who ends up pregnant and gives birth in an alley, and that's actually one of the lines. It's like, you're a crackhead that gave birth in an alley, and it has this like Lifetime movie overtone.
It's a little on the nose.
But there's all this underlying, you know, thing about like crack addiction in the black community and things like that. But she gives birth, throws the baby in the trash literally during one of her highs, and the baby is discovered right in the nick of time by the trash guys that are trash hauling, and you know they have to close the thing, and like they hear the baby crying and save it from being crushed So they take the baby to the hospital, and Jessica Lange is a doctor, OBGYN, someone in, or a social worker, someone working in the hospital, and sees the baby like struggling to live, and eventually the baby gets weaned off. Crack babies, terrible term, but that's what they're called. Born addicted to crack, they have to be weaned off of, as you know, they mm-hmm. have breast milk and crack is in their system, and so on and so forth. So Jessica Lange is like, you know what, I'm gonna adopt this baby as one of my own. She's got this husband and daughter, and they're all adjusting weird to having this new black kid in their home, and the baby grows up around like 5 or 6, and that's when the differences start to become present. It's just like the kid notices,
and then his mother reenters his life.
Yeah, and during this whole like 5 or 6 year time span, Halle Berry's character is getting clean. She's getting back on her feet, and she's like, "Oh, wait a minute! I had a baby 6 years ago. Where's that baby?"
oh yeah.
So it becomes a custody battle, unprecedented in the movie, at least.
Is this based on reality?
I don't think so.
I got the idea that I came away with a thought like it was based on a true story, but I wasn't sure.
And see, this is where I think if an actual lawyer or attorney were to watch this movie, they would call out like, this is wrong, this is wrong. But long story short, there's a custody battle that ensues with a lot of racial overtones. The big question in the movie is, can a white family raise a black child.
Yeah.
And this was like mid-90s. We've 22 years ago.
1995. Yeah. Wow.
So hopefully we've progressed a little bit in our thinking since then. There are obviously a lot of mixed race families and things like that, but at the time, it was a pretty big deal to kind of talk about this. And but it is kind of hilariously overacted at point. So
the only two things most of what I remember from it was that it's kind of early Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes.
Post Pulp Fiction, but still kind of early Samuel L. Jackson. But
how many times did he say motherfucker in the movie?
He said it 0 times.
Oh, okay. Then I don't need to see this movie.
the reason the story about the fade reminded it from me is the only thing I remember from it is Isaiah, the kid, 5, 6 years old, has an older adopted sister, probably 11 or 12-year-old blonde girl. And at one point during the custody battle, she puts his hand on her hand and says, "Isaiah, what's the difference?" And he said, "That's silly. My hand's smaller." And so that's
he had no concept. Right. Yeah. Okay. So others, racial identity, when did you become aware of it?
I was in middle school because it was an actual conversation. I went to a predominantly black school. And my friend at the time, I was friends with everybody, but the group I hung out with, they were all white. And we just had a great time. We matched on Tuesdays. We had lunch. Someone's mom would bring us lunch on Wednesdays. We were like the cool kids. Well, at one point, one of my black friends was like, "Why don't you ever hang out with us?" I was like, "What do you mean?" She's like, "You don't ever eat lunch with us."
Because your mom doesn't bring lunch.
It was McDonald's.
Oh, okay.
But I thought about it, and I was like, well, I mean, I can sit with you guys tomorrow. And it was really, I didn't sit with them because at the time, I couldn't relate. But it was like one of the popular black kids, and I went to a black school, and it was like, man, if I hang out with them, if I become black, then I'm going to be cool. So kind of from there, I started hanging out with them, and they kind of made me realize that, you know, there was nothing wrong with me, but at home, we didn't eat greens. We didn't eat fried chicken. Because my mom doesn't like it. So at home, it was like, we just, you know, eat food. We don't watch BET because I'm not allowed to listen to secular music. So it was really, I couldn't, like, relate to that. But, like, hanging out with, like, my black friends at the time, they kind of showed me, like, "Hey, have you ever tried hot sauce?" And I'm like, "No." And they're like, "Well, hey, try this on chips. It's good." So I tried it, and I was like, "This is kind of good." They're like, "Hey, have you listened to Ja Rule?" I was like, "No, who's that?" And they played it. I was like, "This is awful, and I love it." So it was middle school. Like, I just remember, like, realizing, like, okay, well, I am black. I'm Mexican as well. But, you know, this is something new, and I like it, and I can identify with it the more I learned about it.
Michelle?
So I grew up just north of Dallas. And
Big D represent.
Big D represent. Or I guess the Southern D.
Yeah.
My family was interesting. They were very Christian, but it was one of the offshoots, like Christian Science and Southern Baptist. And my grandparents were all very racist, and so then my parents were on the farm.
You don't have to be from Texas to have racist grandparents.
Oh, man. I mean, until the day they died, they all were. I mean, it's just, yeah. It was uncomfortable. But my parents swung the other way, and I realized, I don't remember realizing that I was white and I was different. I probably remember realizing my privilege more strongly than I do my identity.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Gibson just walked in the room.
Hello, everybody.
When did you first become aware of your racial identity?
I grew up on the south side of Chicago, which is like the most segregated, one of the most segregated areas in the country. So I didn't encounter whiteness outside of television probably until middle of elementary school years, like when we would go downtown, because you wouldn't even see white people in person. Like, you can live on the south side of Chicago and never see white people for years if you want to. So I don't ever recall a moment in which I became aware that I was black. I do recall moments in which other black kids made me aware that the ways in which I moved in and spoke and engaged the world felt to them or read to them as white.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, we'll get to that on the back half.
I became aware of Gibson's racial identity when I heard that voice.
You know, I think I've, since I was raised in the military, I was raised around all sorts of different types of people. So there was an upside to that. I don't think I became really aware of my blackness in terms of it being a liability until I, one, started swimming in white evangelical church culture, and then also when my best friend of three and a half, four years called me nigger. It was interesting because we were playing basketball. We were playing basketball, and I played soccer. There is already a red flag that I'm not black enough because I'm playing soccer, even though most of the world plays soccer.
I played soccer.
And one of the best soccer players in the world. Yeah, Pele was black. I mean, like,
a lot of the best soccer players, are black. In the world, yeah.
But anyway, but in America, we don't really, you know, like soccer all that much outside of, you know, high school, maybe college. There's not a real professional love for it like it is around the world. But either way, at the time, it's the 90s. We're playing basketball. We're shooting a game of 21. This guy always would beat me. Because he was good at basketball. And so we always joked, oh, you know, we got mixed up somehow because you're supposed to be the kid who likes soccer and I'm supposed to be the kid who's good at basketball, right? Well, he'd always beat me. And I remember one day, somehow, I beat him and the ball's coming down through the net and he catches it. And he goes, "Nigger!" I was like, well, who are you talking to? I'm like, oh my God, he's directing this at me. He's mad at me. And that's what came out of him. And at that point, I realized my racial identity as a liability. Like, I knew I was black, but it didn't matter. We were the generation where it didn't matter, right? We're just, why can't everybody just get along? That's our parents' generation, the civil rights movement, whatever, that's gone. Thanks for what you did. We're living out your dream. And then here I am being called the N-word. By my best friend, and when I said, "Hey, you know what the hell was with that?" He's like, "Oh no, I call all my friends out." I'm like, "We have all the same friends. you never use that word unless you're calling me that out. You know, you call me out my name when I'm not here to those same people." So it's interesting. To this day, I still always wonder, you know, of my white friends, do they secretly think that about me? You know, am I one of the good ones? Am I okay as long as I don't cross a line and beat you at something that you feel you should be good at? And then, you know, that racial ire comes out. And so I think at that point is when I became more aware of my racial identity, to be sure. I always knew I was black, but as a liability, that's when that happened. So let's move forward, though, here. What are some of the unwritten rules of your racial culture? What are the rewards for following them, and what are the consequences of breaking them? Anybody can jump in here.
Maybe my answer to number two can lead into number three. So I first became aware of my racial identity in preschool. Preschool, you're like 5 or 6, right? I already seen Sesame Street, but I already seen like black people on TV, white people on TV. Like, it's not like any race was foreign to me. My grandmother actually had Indian friends, from, you know, we're talking like South Asia, not Native American, like Indian friends that were saris and whatnot. So at a very, like from birth, I had been exposed to different races. But I remember in preschool, I went to a very mixed preschool at the time. My mom was finishing up her degree at U of M at the time, and we were living in Ann Arbor. And Ann Arbor being, I went to a preschool that was like in Pittsfield Township. And if you know Washtenaw County, Pittsfield Township is the border, is the buffer between Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor being mostly white, Ypsilanti being a really racially mixed, and still is at the time. And I had a crush on a little white girl in preschool. And like, it was around, somebody said something to the effect of chasing around this little white girl in the playground and stuff like that. And like, I knew that it was like something clicked right around there. It's just like, something is telling me that this is not right. You know, it's like you become sort of aware, like, you know, that there's a difference between black and white, but now, you know, there's a difference between black and white. And,
that continues through adulthood. Just that one.
So through adulthood, I think one of the unwritten rules that has been clearly been broken several times is the idea of having a partner, or a spouse or what have you, that is the same race as you. So my grandparents, for example, my grandfather broke that rule. My grandfather married my grandmother. They settled down, had a family, had my mom. And then when my mom became a teenager, they divorced. And at the same time, it sounds like a Kanye West song. As soon as he gets on, you leave before a white girl. And that's exactly what happened. My grandfather got his PhD, got a better job. The divorce came and he married a white woman. So
I was afraid you were going to say Gold Digger.
No.
Well, that's the song, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That is the song.
And, you know, divorces are messy as is, but my grandfather's family was fully accepting of the situation. They were probably a little more upset about the divorce than his choice of a second wife. But there was, growing up, there was kind of this like understood rule for like me, my cousin, my little brother, and people like that to kind of like, okay, you saw how this situation played out. Don't repeat that, you know. And it's like, are you telling us not to repeat the divorce, or are you telling us not to repeat marrying outside of our race? So it's not like we would disappoint anybody in our family, but there's still kind of that like silent expectation, I guess. You know, if that makes sense. And it's kind of like, I feel like black people sort of have that sixth sense for it, but maybe non-black people don't. But you do kind of see it in other cultures sometimes. Like, you know, we wonder out loud, like, why don't you see two Asian couples together? You know, like, I think it's Asian men that have the hardest time. But you always see Asian women with white men and things like that. And, you know, do those same conversations play out in those households and so on and so forth? It's one of those things that, like, I think is one of our unwritten rules.
Yeah, another unwritten rule, I think, within African-American culture that I ran into, and I think it's more fueled by, I would say, more pop culture and poor thinking in general, because when you look statistically at the success rates of black people, especially black women in this world, black women are the most educated sector of women in the United States, period, full stop. But I do know growing up that there seemed to be a lot more people who looked like me, my age, people who look like me, saying or teasing me for the way that I spoke. You know, I speak very proper. My mom was an English teacher. She said, if you don't want to get a good job when you grow up, you got to speak, you know, basically the Queen's English. When I call on the phone, I've had, really interesting things happen where I would call Barnes & Noble. Hey, do you have this book in stock? Do you have this book by this black author? And I remember the lady saying to me, "Sir, that's African American section." And then I went to Barnes & Noble, and the woman was black, and I was black, and we kind of had this, oh, she thought she was correcting a white guy, you know, and so it was kind of this interesting thing. But when I was younger, one of the big things that seemed to be impressed upon me by people who looked like me who were my own age was to be smart was a bad thing. To get good grades was a bad thing. Now, we all strove to get good grades, but there was kind of this unwritten rule that if you were smart, that you were somehow not black. You were white. You were being like the white kids because of the way you speak, and you're always getting good grades. You're always raising your hand in class to answer the questions. None of us are doing that. And so that was a weird thing that didn't exist once I got to college, but it definitely existed through middle school and high school. But when I got to college, that disappeared, because I think most of the black students at the school that I was at were grateful that they even, you know, that they were even there, given the backgrounds that a lot of them came out of. But that was a strange unwritten rule that I think exists in certain sectors. My niece is dealing with that now. Like, she had to transfer out of the school that she was in because she was called teacher's pet. She was ridiculed for making, you know, really good grades, and she started to hide it. And she started to purposely fail tests or give wrong answers so as to not look as smart as she actually is. And so that was a weird one that I ran into. Any other unwritten rules of your culture? Or
yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I keep hearing that one, the one you just described about schools, and that absolutely was not my experience in Chicago public schools,
right,
which is interesting because Chicago public schools are, you know, at the time they were considered like some of the worst schools in the country. Kids ridicule people for not being smart. Like, if you were considered dumb in my school, you got a clown. So when people sell me this,
yeah,
I'm always like, maybe it's a city by city thing or a school system
Detroit too.
I know plenty. Like, I think that there's a difference between being considered smart and speaking proper. Like, I got teased for speaking proper. I got teased for always having a book in my hand. But everybody clowned the person who got bad grades in class. Everybody clowned the person who got held back a grade. Like, everybody. So there was this tension between, like, you know, some of the, like, I learned very quickly to code switch about my language. So that I spoke a certain way with my friends.
Define what code switching.
So code switching, you know, because I got tired of being told that I spoke proper, and my mother was not an English teacher. She, you know, graduated with GED, but my family's always had a pretty good grasp of verbal language. And so to the extent that she was aware, she knew what the grammar rules were. And if I broke them in the house, I had to repeat the accurate way of saying it five times. So, like, for instance, I ain't got no. I would have to say I don't have any five times. And so I learned very quickly at home I had to speak one way. But in the street, it was like a mixture of, because Chicago's, you know, up south. So it would be a mixture of southern, urban, street slang with my friends. Now, the challenging thing was that my mom would also send me to white spaces like tennis camp and skiing. These are things that black kids in the 80s did not do, that my mother kept sending me to, because in her mind, her attitude was I was going to have to be able to maneuver around a white world if I was going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And
same reason my mom made me speak, you know, the Queen's English.
So, right. Correct. Like, and so for her, any opportunity I can give you that's going to expand how you think about the world, but also give you things of interest in common with the power structure, you'll have that growing up. And so I did. But so I would go away to camp, and then I would come back home, and I'd be like, oh my God, that is totally rad. Like, it was so great. And my friends would be like, the fuck? And I would get beaten until I learned how to speak what way else. And they were like, okay, you got it. Like, I don't, you know, we're going to stick with that. And so I learned very quickly that. But, you know, people who were smart were exalted. But to your question around rules of blackness, I think it depends on whether or not you're considered pro-black. I think if as a pro-black activist, there are certain things you can't not do. Like, I keep getting into debates because it's irritating to me when people say, well, you can't be pro-black if you have a white partner. Mm-hmm. Like, it irks me to no end. Yep. I do not have a white partner. I've not dated anybody white in over 20 years. But if I were to fall in love with somebody white, does that negate 23 years of public service to black community? Like, that to me is crazy.
The answer for some people is yes, it does.
And a lot of people, right. And so I think that that's definitely one. I think another one is, I think that there are, you know, you're supposed to engage certain aesthetics in black culture. So, like, you're supposed to be cool. Like, if you're conscious in black, then you have to be cool with the Ericas and the Jills and the Commons. You have to listen. You have to, you know, wear certain types of clothing. They have to be down with the incense. You're like, there's like kind of these aesthetic cultural rules which are interesting and not always spoken. And I guess the last one, just to be funny, you cannot bring bad potato salad or macaroni and cheese
not.
To anyone's
but
house.
That's a written rule. I believe I have a sign you coming into my house.
I did want to point out that
why is Becky's macaroni salad in the trash?
What's wrong with Becky? I did want to point out that Michael and I have a lot in common.
Yes,
more than you would think. For instance, Michael grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I have seen Hoop Dreams, which takes place on the south side of Chicago.
I've seen the movie South Side by You. That was a good one.
I watched Coolie High.
I used to buy my hair products on the south side of Chicago.
There you go. Look at everybody you. Got that south side connection.
Yeah, I've only been there one time. So, Michelle and Kent, I want to ask you, both as the resident white people in the room.
I live here. The resident.
Are there unwritten rules to being white? Are there rules that we're unaware of as black people? That
there's just so many of us. It's true, hard to have. I mean,
black people aren't monolithic, but we still have these rules, so...
You must love strudel.
I have a bit of a thing against anything artificially fruit flavored, like fruit syrups, like pie. Pie is terrible, and you know, you probably disagree with me because I know I'm in a minority. But I would far
How's
rather have cake than I'd far rather have cake than pie.
I don't like pie either though.
Right.
So I just like the
but
crust.
That's our Mexican side.
That's right. No.
Our black side.
She likes
like,
tapas.
Come on!
I don't know.
No, I'm just kidding.
yeah. So unwritten rules of whiteness.
Wait, liking pie is... Did you attribute that as a black thing?
No, I...
Okay, because...
I get the idea...
Because I hate cake, and I like pie.
Right,
but I've never thought about it as a racial thing.
I get the idea, and this may be totally wrong, that pie might be... blacker than like more for black people than for white people.
Things
I don't know.
I never considered.
I see my mother-in-law make so many pies from scratch, but this is a Southern thing. So
that makes.
But that's
but
interesting.
What about like shepherd's pie? Like I think that's
shepherd's
pie.
The stuff with the meat
that's
in
some
it.
White people stuff.
Yeah,
that's
a pie. I was gonna say that's a pie that is I associate more with white people than black people.
Shepherd's pie. I've never had it.
I don't even know what's in it.
It's mashed potatoes, British. Hamburger. Cheese.
Yeah, it's a lot of shit that's supposed to be separate on a plate.
It's, like, yeah. 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 It's exactly what it
pie.
Is.
It's like a chicken pot pie with mashed potatoes instead of crust on top.
Yeah, it's
so
really
I don't
good.
Know.
It doesn't sound terrible.
Right, it's amazing.
It, like
it's
a
it did take a white person
right?
to explain
right.
exactly
it's a
what it was, though. Didn't it?
Yes.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, yeah. So Michelle, racial...
So, unwritten rules of racial culture. Rules tend to be restrictive when we run into them, and so I've found many times where I don't have to follow a rule. Like I lived in Atlanta for a year, and I realized really fast that everybody who was dark skinned drove 5 miles under, and anybody else could drive however they wanted, and it was ridiculous.
So it's again kind of noticing your privilege, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I was like a pregnant. Teacher's wife, living in Decatur, you know, middle class family, driving a station wagon. I was going 90. Nobody ever said a thing. And it was unfair.
Okay. So let's move forward.
So after Bacon's Rebellion, there was a calculated effort to change perceptions about people. Differences were no longer based on country of origin, but rather on skin color. So if race and quote-unquote being black is merely social engineering, why do we feel so attached to the concept?
I'm going to jump in right here. This goes back before.
Is there a chance you could jump in and explain what Bacon's Rebellion is? Because I just have
okay,
notes.
So she's the anthropologist. Yeah. I'm the historian. Let me do the Bacon's Rebellion thing. So
excuse me.
Oh, okay. Let me mansplain.
Go ahead. Why don't you? So,
well, actually.
So before Bacon's Rebellion.
It was well before. Yeah.
All right. So we can go back to the caveman. The way our brains work when we see a threat being anything we have not encountered before in our lives, we quickly have to categorize it and deal with it. And so we have found ways to categorize things and fit them into boxes so that we can like assess the threat and move on. Before race, we would divide people by their religion or their ethnicity. Persians today still can tell who's Afghani, and they look down on them culturally by their noses. So we've always had ways of dividing people. When the Spanish conquistadors came to the New World and they left their wives back, you know, on the Iberian Peninsula, and they started mating with the native cultures there. And so because their society had such a strict and rigid dividing, you had the aristocracy, you had the working class, you had the lower classes. And so when you had only the aristocrats coming to an area, and then they're having kids with other populations, they had to develop a new way to keep their structure. And so they came up with something called the pigmentocracy, which was based on skin color. And that is the first time in human history we've ever divided people based on that.
Interesting.
And so Bacon's Rebellion picked up on that, and then anthropology tried to scientifically back it up. So if you want to explain Bacon's Rebellion, I can explain the science.
Yeah. Nat, and I apologize for like just jumping in and
that's
starting
right.
to mansplain. Like, oh, she clearly is not going to know what Nat. Okay. So anyway, Nat Bacon. Who was actually a cousin of Francis Bacon. But Nat Bacon was essentially he was a guy who was a farmer, and he got all of these poor whites. He got black slaves and indentured servants to all essentially rebel against the ruling power, the ruling elite. Okay, so
every 200 years there's a black slave uprising.
Well, here's the thing.
There was another one in like 18.
This thing wasn't this wasn't just a black slave uprising.
Okay.
Okay. So this isn't Nat Turner. Okay. This is Nat Bacon. And so he's got everybody. And so the problem with everybody getting on the same page against people in power squashed a rebellion. They almost lost. Okay. And so then what they said is we need to essentially socially engineer a way so that blacks and whites are pitted against each other. So they won't ever team up ever again because of what we just saw here. And so when you've got something like that happening, you have black people and white people who are at the same station in life. Okay, that's how the rebellion happened. Hey, you know what? You're poor and black. I'm poor and white. We got the same interests at heart. Well, now you've got ideas coming along after Nat's rebellion is squashed of, hey, at least you're not black. Yeah, you're poor, but at least you're not black poor. You're actually black poor. But it's just this perceptual thing. Hey, at least you're not black. At least we don't look down on you for your heritage. At least we don't view you as property or subhuman or cattle. That was really what kind of came out of that socially.
So there's quite an advantage to people in power when you, you know, I've thought about this a lot. Like as a culture, we don't lift people up across the board. We gain our own position by pushing others down, whether that be based on race or gender or social economic status. So to propagate this, you know, putting like lifting up of whites and putting blacks down, an anthropologist named Morton used to like measure people's skulls, and the idea was like, oh well, the Asian skull or the Mongoloid skull has this much volume and the Caucasian skull has this much and the Negroid skull. I mean, and they developed all these classifications. And it's total bunk science. I mean, the size of your skull is related to the size of your body. It has nothing to do with your intelligence. We don't say that, like, short people are smarter than tall people. It's kind of the same correlation. It sounds ridiculous, but it was, like, all the rave. And actually, anthropologists kind of, ever since then, have been trying to fight it. And it's frustrating because we're still talking about this and we're still labeling people. And the science has been proven wrong, like, over 100 years ago, and we're still believing it. And there's some anthropologists that say, actually, like, if you acknowledge race, you're perpetuating the racism.
Anybody else? Thoughts? Why do we cling to this stuff? If we know it's made up, if we know it's engineered, why is it so important to us?
I think there's something to be said about how the African-American race has developed in America, because as our history goes, you know, we were brought here from Africa and so much of our culture was taken away from us that we have had to strive to not only preserve what little culture we could, but also sort of create our own. So when we talk about like being really attached to the idea of being black or whatever you want to, or the concept of being black, there's a lot of cultural things shared across many, not all, but many African-Americans that are just so unique to us. Like, it's like we're all in on a joke and we share that, and we have all these social cues. We have all these shared experiences. We have all these things in common that it makes us who we are. And we can easily move into different spaces. You know, like I'm from Detroit, but I can go to a Chicago and feel at home. I can go to a Charlotte, North Carolina, or I can go to, you know, South Central LA, or I can go to, Seattle, where Quincy Jones is from, and find his old neighborhood. And, you know, it's Seattle being a predominantly white city. But if I find like the one black neighborhood that's there, I know that we'll find some common ground somewhere. There may be regional differences, like, okay, Chicago has deep dish pizza and Detroit has Coney dogs and things like that. But there is so much of a shared black experience across generations and things like that, that this is sort of why we cling to it. And this is why we also get offended when non-black people sort of try to capitalize on it. And then I think any culture could say the same thing. If you look at, Latinos and how Latinos preserve theirs, but also become offended when a non-Latino tries to capitalize off of it, or it happens perpetually with Asian cultures, as far as, Katy Perry, who's frequently in the news. I remember a couple, she's in the news now because it's just like she's kind of had this come to Jesus moment. She's just like, oh my gosh, I might be a cultural appropriator. And she's in literally every culture is like, really? Because you bit off of this, you bit off of that, you bit off of that. There's been a few times where she's performed in traditional Japanese dress, in traditional Chinese dress, and both those communities railed against her. They keep saying, like, you know, our culture is not a costume. Same with Hawaiian cultures, and how, when Halloween comes around and people want to dress like Moana, there's a line you have to walk on so that, you know, you are paying homage and not being offensive. So this is all these things that when we talk about clinging to the concept of it, I think it's more of a cultural thing that we try to hold on to because our culture has defined so much of who we are.
Okay.
I think for me, one, you know, definitely recognizing race as a social construct, and that, you know, there are 400 other different ways to classify human beings, right, anthropologically speaking. That said, though, I think we're also, there are things that we are still kind of learning about these groupings. For instance, you know, epigenetics and the idea of blood memory, and that it of kids in L.A. who have never been exposed to African dance, thinking they're inventing crunk dancing, and only to find out you can find crunk dancing in exactly the same style hundreds of years ago and now in African cultures and tribes that they have never been exposed to, right? So I think that there's something to be said for
what we still don't know yet about what we carry and what we pass down across generations as cultural information in our DNA. I think there's also when we get mad about cultural appropriation, so much of that is built into the idea of, well, it wasn't valuable before, so why you don't get to say it's valuable to you now so that you can capitalize off of it. Hmm. You know, if it wasn't valuable, you know, as I'm a little petty, if it wasn't valuable enough before, then we just gonna keep doing it ourselves with us, and you can't have it, you can't be partaking in this, right? Like, and so I think that there's that, and I think the cultural appropriation argument probably wouldn't have been made as vehemently as it has been made in probably the last 5 to 10 years if white people who engaged in it didn't deny it. Like, like they'll create it, and there's all this new trend in vogue, Timberlands without socks is the new rage this spring. And you're like, Timberlands without socks has been the rage in black community.
Thanks, Taylor Swift.
And I wish I was making a joke, but that actually was in vogue, and that actually just happened in the last year. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so I think that that resistance is about economics and about value. And it's also about pride. And I'm grateful that we're now back in a resurgence of black pride, because, you know, I was around for the ex-caps and the Public Enemy and all of that kind of era that was happening in the late 80s, early 90s. We were very prideful and very proud of our Africanness. And then that kind of like ebbed away. And so I think we have another cycle where we're there again. I hope it's not trend. I hope it's just the new way of life, because we do need it. So, yeah, I'm pro-black culture. I'm pro the idea of preserving black culture while recognizing that blackness is not an essentialist thing.
Okay.
I think we have the celebration of kind of like any culture that's not white right now. Like, there's a resurgence of Native Americans, like, since the 80s when the Secretary of Interior said that there were no tribes and then they could finally get their own identity back. I mean, it just blows my mind. Another thing that it kind of, please correct me if I'm wrong, this reminds me a little bit of like transgender. Like, if there's someone that's born a man and he wants to be a girl or a female or a woman, I'm not offended. I don't think that, you know, like, does that make me any less of a woman if somebody chooses to be like me? Or, and I'm not even honored by it. It's just kind of like, well, that's that person. That's what they like, what they want. And so, I mean, is there a correlation there between like appropriating culture and transgender? Or
I think people would see some touch points and some people wouldn't. I would definitely, I mean, just not even on the transgender thing. We're going to do an episode about that here in a few weeks, as a matter of fact. But just the idea of cultural appropriation is kind of an interesting thing in terms of being raised in white culture. I have to sometimes step back and realize that what I'm thinking right now is the way that white culture thinks about this. And I know if I say it to black people, I'm going to get a lot of pushback. Like, for instance, you know, the whole Moana thing. Like, oh, my God, you know. I remember when that movie came out. I loved it. You know, I love Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I think he's great. I love that the girl who plays the voice of Moana is actually Hawaiian. I thought that was great. But I remember a lot of Hawaiians being very upset that Disney did not portray Maui the way that he is actually portrayed in their culture. And my thought was, like, God, you have no Hawaiian heroes in pop culture. Disney makes a movie that's completely dedicated to it. You're like, you got his weight wrong. I'm like, okay, you know, what do you want? And I realize that's like white thinking. Like, it's like, you know, hey, you know what?
Is Maui like a little guy? I mean,
Maui in Hawaiian culture and all the pictures that they were showing, he's very slender and very muscular and very slender. They made him fat and muscular in this.
Yeah, like a big Polynesian.
Oh, I saw it. Yeah. And so.
But my initial thought was like, yo, God, don't you want anything? At least got to start somewhere. But that is also what many white people say to me when I'm pushing back hard on racist things that they're saying. And so representation, I think there's something to being accurate when you're, or at least trying to represent something. You should try to be accurate, strive for accuracy.
I don't know. I also think like, see, a lot of, so this is a poor example because it's like literary license. Like I took my son to go see Wonder Woman and he's all about Greek mythology. And he was so mad. He's like, this is really messed up, Mom. Like Otrera was the queen of the Amazons. And like her daughter Hippolyta was actually the daughter of Ares. And so if Wonder Woman's going to go kill Ares and say goodbye, brother, that's inaccurate because it's actually her grandfather.
You know? So oh, he sounds just fun.
Hollywood.
But here's
the he clearly doesn't read the comic.
but here's the reason why, you know, people nitpick. It is because this a movie like Moana may be the one and only time a movie about Hawaiian culture may be made because there's so few to go off of. So if there's not as many in rotation, if they don't come as frequently, then you have to get it right. You have to get it right. I mean, there are so many marginalized cultures and so many cultures that don't get portrayed on the big screen or the small screen or what have you, that if the one chance you get and everybody's excited about it comes through, then it has to be done right. I was reading something about the Joy Luck Club. And to my surprise, the Joy Luck Club, I watched that one with my grandmother when I was younger. And, you know, it was a tearjerker and very mm-hmm. emotional and things like that. But since 91 or 92, since that movie has been made, there has never been a major motion picture studio production with an all Asian or Asian American cast. There's been a few indie movies with all Asian cast, and I do mean a few, but there's never been, like, even though this movie hit on all the points, critically acclaimed,
what about
made a lot of money.
What about Memoirs? I thought that was the next one after it. Memoirs of a Geisha.
So that was years later.
So there's like a 20-year gap.
Though. Yeah, still, yeah. They're not coming out often.
But pretty sure there was a white guy in Memoirs of a Geisha. So it wasn't...
Speaking specifically to the Asian American experience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, you got tons of like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, mm-hmm. and stuff with subtitles, right? But speaking specifically to an English language major motion picture thing that hit on all the marks that Hollywood looks for. Was it critically acclaimed? Yes. Did it make its money back on the box office? Yes. Did it hold over like through the years? Yes. But there's never been that big major studio push for a similar movie. So now there's talk of Crazy Rich Asians, which is a sort of cross-continental Asian story. And immediately, like, the question is, like, how right can we get it? It has to stay true to the book. It has to have the right casting. It has to have the right everything. Because, you know, like I said, when you have movies about certain cultures, be it black, Asian, Latino, what have you, and you're leaving it in the hands of people who can take creative license, then it has to be done right because we have so few of those to go off of, and those become our standards. You know, like Joy Luck Club, that's pretty much the only thing when it comes to a big motion picture studio that the Asian American community has. And by all accounts, it did go right for them, but you know, that's why we have to keep getting it right.
I was going to say, as we're about to take it to break, I just wanted to mention that when Aaron started to talk about mentioned Moana and said this might be the one chance for Hawaii we get it right. So immediately I pull out my phone, hoping to prove him wrong by Googling Moana 2, because I figure they've got to have Moana 2 in the pipeline. And there's no concrete news on Moana 2, but I did find this factoid saying there is a Mulan live action movie coming.
Oh yeah, that's the next one.
With the possibility of Jennifer Lawrence playing Mulan. That ain't cool. Oh,
here we go again.
That's not cool at all.
I literally caved in on myself.
So let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back and we'll talk about kind of this idea of our first experiences with being told we're not black enough and where that comes from. Well, hey, everybody. We're back from break. Thanks so much for staying on the line there. Let's dive right back into questions. Again, the episode is titled Black Enough, A Conversation About Racial Identity. We had a really good front half of the show. So let's dive deep into the back half of the show as well. Have you ever been accused of not being black enough? What were the specific reasons? And what achievement was made or what rule was broken?
this might be a good chance to bring up Miss Saigon.
Shut up.
No. It was an actual thing we were talking about this very thing that happened.
Okay, so you're talking about it on the break, so go on.
Are you familiar with Miss Saigon?
It's a Broadway musical, yes.
Yes, but before it was a Broadway musical, it was a musical in the West End in London.
Okay.
Written by the...
Les Miserables,
written by the creators of Les Miserables, and I think it's pretty definitively their second place work.
Okay,
I like
financially, yeah,
yes, okay, yes, definitely financially. But it ran very successfully from opened, I want to say, 1989 in London, and set a ticket sales record, ticket sales record for the time for its transfer to New York in 90 or 91 or something like that. And part of the deal to transfer was the three main roles, the girl who played Miss Saigon, her boyfriend, an American soldier.
And the engineer.
And the engineer, who was a half-French, half-Vietnamese pimp. who employed Miss Saigon, Kim, Kim. who was her pimp.
So I basically never want to see this play.
And kind of her protector during some of the hard times. But,
of course, for all the situations he was putting her in.
And right. This is a musical?
This is a musical. Okay. Yes, it is a musical. So, Kim, the soldier whose name has escaped
Chris.
Me, Kim, Chris, and the engineer were all going to transfer to Broadway. The engineer, the role was created by actor Jonathan Pryce, who modern-day audiences may know from Game of Thrones or Pirates of the Caribbean. He was Keira Knightley's father in the Pirates movies.
Okay.
He was like the high priest of the Taliban in Game of Thrones. And he's worked consistently for in the U.S. for 25 years. But he was going to recreate his role on Broadway as the half-French, half-Vietnamese pimp. And the Actors' Equity Union, the Stage Actors' Union, said, we're not going to allow the show to open because Jonathan Pryce is not Asian. And the role is Asian. And the comeback, I guess, Cameron McIntosh, the producer, he said, well, the role is half Asian, half European. And Equity said that doesn't matter. The role is, as a Eurasian, should be played by an Asian actor to give an Asian actor the chance. And Cameron McIntosh, who was not yet a billionaire, but was still had a lot of money. He's a billionaire now. Said no. And Equity said, then we're not going to allow you to open unless you recast the role. And he said, not coming. And they canceled the show. And eventually they got over it.
And they got their show with Jonathan Pryce.
And by got over it, I mean Equity folded. I mean, yeah. That's what this question reminded me of, in that sometimes you have to – well, in this case, it wasn't a subject of being black enough. It was a subject of being looking the right way to play a certain
– Asian at all?
Yes.
I think this piggybacks on the previous conversation about Moana. So Miss Saigon – I'm about to outwhite Kent here, which is me not being black enough. As you see,
I don't know if you're going to outwhite me.
On this subject, okay. I know Miss Saigon inside and out, including the controversy. So the challenge is – the show itself is problematic, right? Like, spoiler for anybody who's not familiar enough with the show, the show ends with the woman committing suicide in order to make sure her Asian child is sent off with the white folks
to go get raised in America.
Now playing at the Broadway Theater in New York.
Literally. Buy your now playing. Now, was nominated for Tony's.
Buy your $120 tickets for a show. Gibson just gave away the ending to
it. And, you know, it's a 25-year-old show. Like, and
yeah, literally, it's there's a spoiler alert.
There's
right?
an anniversary DVD out about it now of the most current cast. You know, so we're talking about, like, representations of Asians, and lots of Asians are deeply offended by this show. And but it was kind of like, oh, but it's the only one. And so, like, for 25 years, if you're an Asian actor, you have starred in the Flower Drum Song.
I was
going
to bring a Flower Drum Song.
Miss Saigon.
South Pacific.
Pacific Overtures.
Okay.
Or South Pacific.
Okay. What about The King and I?
Or The King and I.
Yes.
So you've had, like, five shows. And, like, if you look at the Asian actors, like, Playbill stuff, it's the same five shows, sure. right? Because those are the only representations of them on Broadway, and if you want to be on Broadway, then you have to perpetuate these stereotypes of shows that
are problematic. Are you saying that every 31-year-old white guy in New York hasn't played Marius in Phantom of the Opera? Marius
saying,
and Les Mis. But Raoul in Phantom of the Opera.
But that 31-year-old white guy has probably about 300 other options in
he
roles.
He does, right, yes.
Whereas if you're, you know, Kim... What is she gonna do next?
So she's gonna be Fantine next.
I'm finding this fascinating, but I feel like it's a little off track from where I want to go here. So personal stories, honestly, of accusations in your own life where you weren't black enough, where you did something, you achieved something, or you broke a rule or whatever, and someone said you weren't black because of X thing. When does that happen for you all?
I mean, it's happened just in conversation. I remember hanging out with friends, and it got real quiet in the room. Everyone's, like, just doing their own thing. You know, you hang out, it just gets kind of quiet. And then all of a sudden, my friend was like, have you all ever noticed how Angelica says all the letters in all of her words all of the time? And I was like, huh? And then everyone, like, looked at me, and they're like, yeah, you do sound white. You do talk pretty white. And I was like, no, I don't. I say, what up? And they were like, well, say it again. I was like, what up? They were like... Yeah. They're like, you can't even, they were like, you don't even like do the head nod. I was like, I can do it. And I was like, what up? And they're like, yeah, it's even worse.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Skip the head nod. Mean,
it wasn't anything where I felt like less than, but they pointed it out. And from that point, I kind of realized, like, man, I do talk a little different. And even working in telesales, you know, selling things over the phone, people are really brave on the phone. And once they feel comfortable, they will say whatever they want. I was selling like a Trio laser hair removal where darker complexions can't use it, not because they don't want to sell to black people or darker complected people, but they'll get burnt because it's a laser. So I was like asking the question, like, so would you consider yourself fair, medium, or dark skin? And this woman went off on me. She's like, I'm sick of all you white people, something, something. I was like, ma'am, slow your roll because I'm not white, but I need to ask this question because I can ship it out to you. I'd love to get paid on it. You're going to get burnt. So it's just kind of a thing of I've never been black enough when it comes to conversation or dialect or the way I sound because it's just this is how my mother talks. So this is how I talk. It's just the way I was raised.
Okay.
So that's definitely been pointed out many times.
Okay.
I've got a good are you black enough story. 2 months ago when I decided to go work for the white mayor of Detroit.
That'll do it.
Maybe being asked if I'm not being black enough or if I'm being a sellout, maybe there's a Venn diagram there that can be drawn. Not just that, but when I was a kid, I did lots of things that maybe quote-unquote what white kids do. So I used to read Archie comics.
That's like the whitest comic you can read.
Which is funny now because Riverdale is such a popular show. But
if you tune into the Gibson Gazette on Facebook, you'll see some of that. Yeah.
I remember in middle school, somebody asked me if I ever ate pate, as if I was like too proper or whatever. And keep in mind, I grew up in Detroit, right? Detroit is mostly black city. I went to mostly black schools all my life, except preschool. I was kind of into a lot of things that either white kids did or quote unquote black kids didn't do. Then you get asked, like, as you grow older, like, are you a sellout because you do this? Are you a sellout because you do that? When I was in college, I was on my student newspaper. And in college, we're supposed to be adults, right? We're supposed to have, like, a little bit more mature thinking. But at the time, this is 2002, 2003, 2004. This was at the height of affirmative action being discussed at U of M, Michigan State, all the Michigan colleges, right? It was ground zero at U of M, but I was at Michigan State. So there was already this one very thick layer of racial tension on campus. Two, our student newspaper at State, before I started working there, but it carried over into when I did, had a very, very strained relationship with black students on campus. It was largely due to a lack of black staff on the paper, but you know, they were inadvertently, like, I know all these people, right? They're my coworkers, but they would inadvertently write like stereotypical things, make presumptions, assumptions. There was one very notable incident where we had four really good football players that might have been going to the NFL. They were the most wanted in the draft, but in our newspaper we did an illustration of a most wanted poster, and we had their four football mugshots. Like, when you join an athletic team, you take a headshot, but on a wanted poster, it looks like a mugshot. You've got four black men in on a wanted poster, and it was one of those things that on paper sounded like a good idea, but when we printed it, oh my gosh.
It's like the Pepsi commercial. Yeah, yeah. Kendall Jenner. That was your Kendall Jenner moment,
so
right?
We did not think that one through.
And that did us no favors. And so there were a few more incidents like this, and our Black Student Alliance called a town hall with them and the student newspaper, and there were like three black people on staff, myself included, and we're just sitting there getting called every kind of Uncle Tom, sellout, this, that, and never in my life had I been so embarrassed. And I'm thinking to myself, but I'm from Detroit, my whole family is black except for my grandfather's wife, and like, I've gone to DPS, like, everything I've done, I actually dressed as a African prince for Halloween when I was in elementary school because my mom was going through an Afrocentric phase, and she made me a dashiki and a kufi. Like I'm as black as I can be, but it's crazy how many either personal choices I've made when it comes to like entertainment and things like that, or career choices that I've made, where you still get that you're not down for us, mm-hmm. you're not this, you're not that, and it happens now with myself and plenty of my black colleagues who, despite the grand number of black people, and not just black people, but people of color, period, working at the city of Detroit, because the guy at the top is a white guy, then we are all kind of in the same boat as selling out. So,
you know, I get called out primarily, I noted the education thing earlier, but also, you know, my dating habits. When I was, you know, when I was dating, I remember I was using online dating because I was, you know, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish, all that stuff. I was a busy guy in the city. I was working at Verizon Wireless at the time, and so I'd work all day, and then at night I didn't want to have to try to figure out all the mysteries of women. I would just, you know, internet was a time saver, you know? And I was an equal opportunity offender. I dated black, white, Asian, Latino, didn't really matter to me. Just, you know, do we connect on an intellectual level? Do we connect on an emotional level, spiritual level, sexual level? Are we firing on all cylinders, so to speak, right? And I remember a black woman telling me, you know, hey, you know what? I had reached out to her. Hey, you know what? I liked your profile. Seemed like we might be kind of a match. You know, same thing that every single guy says on these dating sites. I think we might be a match based on what you said about yourself. And her response back to me wasn't, hey, you know what? Thank you. I'm flattered. You know, but I'm just, you know, I'm not feeling the same thing. It was, you know what, I'm looking for a real black man, and you're not it. And I was like, whoa. But in my profile, I said, you know, I'm an equal opportunity offender. And just the fact that I dated outside of my race, wasn't committed to any. Like, I had specifically even said that, right? I mean, obviously where I landed marriage-wise, I ended up with a white person. So can I really sell that now? But back then, know, again, I was dating everybody. I cared, you know, that we could relate. And being told that was really difficult for me. And it's not that I don't understand a lot of hardworking black women who are defending black men who do, you know, get rich and then go off and get the white girl. Go get, you know, leave your ass for a white girl, as Kanye says, right? But one, that wasn't the narrative I came from. You know, I didn't grow up dating a black girl, supporting my ass, and then, you know, as soon as I make it, I drop her and go get somebody else. That was not my narrative at all. So I understand that. But also because I didn't grow up with the quintessential African-American experience, I committed my life to studying it. I probably know more about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement and slavery than anybody who wears a Malcolm X, a Martin Luther King shirt, you know, whatever. I can dissect all of Tupac's lyrics. And again, part of it came out of a feeling of inadequacy. Like, because I didn't have the black experience, I didn't know what it's like to be black while I'm actually still black. But it's tough to be told, because of being open to dating whoever is around you, you're not a black person. You're not truly black. Like, I'm going to be the first person, when something racist happens to you, who will be able to defend your ass and be able to point to the history of why this is happening to you. Okay? I'm the person that you call later on for this kind of thing. So it's tough for me to be in a situation where now, you know, I'm married to a white woman. You know, I just happened to fall in love with this person. She matched the most. It's hard for that to be the litmus of my blackness. That's a very, very difficult thing to be told, that I'm not black enough when I am very, as you said, Gibson, very pro-black. I'm very pro-black. And, you know, you grew up in Detroit. You're like, all I know is being black. And then all of a sudden to be told that you're not because of some outlying thing out here, that's really difficult for me.
I think for me it's complicated by the fact that I'm gay. Right, and
wait, hold on a second.
What?
What?
Yeah.
Whoa, we don't let gay people in my show.
Right, like,
this
so.
This is the gay panel. What are you doing
You're
here?
You're hilarious. I've been here many times. You know I'm gay. So, in that, and I bring that up because, you know, so much of what was not black enough actually ended up being things that were entirely aligned with queer culture. Right? Like, and so, and I didn't know that then. I came to know that later. The other part of it is I also have come to learn that some of that, what is not black enough, is class-based. Because when I lived in Chicago and in the poor and South Side, and I got all of the pushback from kids about the way that I spoke or my books or my interest in theater, when I moved to Washington, D.C. at 19, there was an entire black community that read those books, that went to go see theater, that skied. That was, you know, and you wouldn't definitely get beat down questioning their blackness on Howard University's campus or University of District of Columbia's campus. And so, which expanded my understanding that blackness isn't just one thing, right? Like, whereas before, I think my understanding of blackness was very much the South Side of Chicago soul food TV experience, right? Like going to church, the black church, and Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, and singing in the choir, yep. And eating fried foods, and knowing what your grandma gonna tell you, and you know, like all of that kind of stuff. And I am so grateful that I had that experience, because I did not experience kind of even as I was being called these things as a kid, as being, you know, quote unquote white, I was definitely living and experiencing the quote-unquote quintessential black experience. My brother and sister, fast forward, who are almost 20 years younger than me in some respect, they grew up in the suburbs, in a white suburb, went to predominantly white schools, did not have a quintessential black experience, did not have the extended family thing, did not do soul food, will not eat that stuff, married or are dating white partners. Mm-hmm. And they don't have any of those touchstones. And, like, their touchstone is, like, Insane Clown Posse. And
Ooh, that's super white.
Right, like, and goth. Even. And, like, and speaking like Minnesotans, like, they're in the episode of Fargo because they live in Minnesota. So, and they do struggle a bit when they come to visit uncles and aunties and cousins to make the connection, because they don't have those cultural touchstones.
I'm glad that I was able to have both. But I think that living in D.C., you know, completely erased any idea that there's only one way to be black. There are plenty of pro-black people who are vegans and listen to country and but still can talk about Malcolm X and talk about Ashada Shakur. Yeah, so
now the other side of this, though, for me has been, I don't know which is more problematic for me. The being as black as I can be, as black as I know to be, as being as educated as a black man about the black experience as I can be. I don't know which is more difficult for me, is when black people tell me that I'm not black enough, or when white people remind me that I'm
black,
right? It's tough when you have, when you grow up and you would hear and you would know, like, you know, as you would know, this white person is trying to compliment me right now. That is what the attempt is. They are failing, but they are trying, right? And so I have to understand their intent, right? You know, hey, Calvin, you're a credit to your race. You're so well-spoken, those kinds of things.
Articulate.
Right, you're so articulate. Yeah. And I am articulate, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, that's...
but I can say it.
Right, but, I mean, I know that's true. It took a while for me to understand that what they were saying was coming from a space of...
Ignorance
or a basic understanding of what they thought black people were. So... The main thing that people would say to me was, Calvin, you're not like other black people, all right? Which betrays their notion of what they think black people are like. And there are times where I have to decide what hill I'm going to die on, right? Is this a moment to educate or am I going to let it pass, right? And there are times where I've stopped and said, okay, so what you're saying to me, and I generally say this more to friends than to strangers. So what you were saying to me, and I want you to hear what you're saying. I know there's no intent to it. So we're still friends. I'm not going to be mad at you. But I want you to hear what you're saying so that you never say it again, okay? So what you're saying is because of the way that I speak, because I have gotten an education, because I make you comfortable, I have somehow transcended my race. Because this is at bottom what you think of my race. So I'm not like other black people. And by other black people, you mean people who you think are ignorant. You mean people who speak poorly, who aren't educated. That's what your view of black people is. Even if you're not stating that and you're not thinking that on a conscious level, that's where that compliment comes from. And I have friends. I got a friend, one of my best friends, stood at my wedding. His name's Tim. Got another guy who stood at my wedding. His name's Brian. Both of them are white guys. And I had that difficult conversation with both of them. We're friends to this day. But they didn't even realize that view that they carried. And to this day, I don't know. I still don't know which one is more difficult for me to hear. Because people, I mean, they don't say it to me anymore because they've been educated, right? But there are still plenty of people who say I'm not like other black people, but then there are other black people who I'm fighting my ass off to support, and I'm not black enough. So it's kind of this weird space to be in as a black person. Like, I don't know which world. I almost feel like my daughter, who's biracial, like she doesn't know which world to be in. And so, anyway, those are...
I stopped associating with those kind of white people. I mean, I grew up.
I definitely did. Unfriended them all on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, I'm married to a woman who doesn't think that way, but her family comes from.
Right.
I think, I mean, Michelle, at the beginning of this, you're like, to the end of their days, they were this way, right? And so it's like my family that I married into, I knew that came with that. It's going to come with the territory. Is she might think this way, but not everybody in her family is going to think this way. And lo and behold, family members who do love me, who do accept me as being her husband, but there are definitely views that they have of black people that have come out that are very unconscious.
But, I mean, part of that also, like, so those were my views of black people, right, in the 80s when I was that special Negro who was at the camp and the only black kid at the camp.
Yeah. You know, that's because the white too, folks when you carry like, it yourself, when you carry
right,
it
like
yourself.
Right, like the other white folks, oh my God, you're so amazing. I'm like, oh my God, I'm amazing here. And then I go back to the hood and I have to fight. right? Like, so, and I think that one of the lessons that I learned before I even heard it very early on is you don't get to be anti-black because you're still carrying child hurt from not fully fitting in back in the day. So that's why you're a rabid Republican anti-black person today.
We've had that guy on our show.
Right. You know, like, go get some therapy, get you over your butt hurt, and get into it. Like, I mean, I think for me, I tell the story that...
Is it okay to joke that the black gay guy is talking about being butt hurt?
I think it's kind of funny. I think it's funny.
Where's that bell?
Come on, that's funny. We're friends now.
Exactly. Right?
By the way,
this is that Bill Maher level of comfort that happens, right?
I
apologize. What's funny is I was like, well, she would know.
I will apologize later if that was super offensive.
No, I'm not. Okay.
Aaron's little sound box there is way more appropriate. The bell, respect the bell. It's for self-aggrandizement.
I might have to steal this.
Continue. I'm sorry. Continue.
I joke with people all the time that...
There it is.
Until I had my moment with the police at age 16, the path I was on was to become the next Clarence Thomas. I was very into, you know, why black people complaining. I knew people who had abused the system. You know, I grew up around poor people. So, of course, I'm growing up around people who are struggling and sometimes bending rules in order to make it. And so all of that was kind of informing. And then I'm having this experience as a queer kid in the black space where I'm not feeling accepted or wanted. Where I now go in white spaces and they just love the hell out of me because I'm the special Negro and they want to touch my hair and call me their best friend and say I'm their new black best friend. And I'm like eating that up like it's candy. But the police very quickly reminded me at age 16 by throwing me in their car that my preppy clothes didn't matter, that the fact that I spoke well didn't matter, the fact that I was in college at the time, or actually, yeah, I was actually in college at the time because I had entered Harold Washington's community college program. And so... none of that mattered. I was a nigga, and they were very clear to tell me I was a nigga. And that was when the first time I stopped distancing myself from black people, and that's when I started to do the reading. Because I wouldn't even read black books outside of, like, Maya Angelou until about 10th grade. Like, because I knew instinctively if I read it, I would be mad. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be able to navigate these white spaces with this kind of blissful special Negro ignorance that I was doing. And I was right. I read those books, and by 19, I was like dressing like a Black Panther, had the fist, was super a black nationalist, you know, one step from being a 5%er kind of a black person.
Not a 5%er.
Yeah, I mean, like,
I went all in, right?
I went all in. You know, my family don't believe in halfways. You know, we all the way or another way. So I think that I'm acutely aware of what that means, and, you know, and people wanting to rub your head when you shave it. And, like, having to educate them that, yo, that was, like, a slave
thing.
Don't touch my hair. You know, like, I'm not a good luck charm. You know, like, so, you know, so anyway, I've had both experiences. And I get where it comes from. But yeah, I can't even associate with white people who would do that to me now.
Does anybody have any perceptual advantages to leaning into your racial identity?
I think so, yeah. Like I said earlier, there's just a lot of just, like, inside jokes and social cues that other black people can pick up on. And I just, as humans, we just love being in on something. We're kind of naturally drawn to be in like a clique or something like that. And sometimes I feel like being black is like being a big ass clique. And like, and it's just like, I know if I say something and I don't mean it to be, to hurt anyone's feelings or anything like that, or just to kind of get the jump on somebody or anything like that. But if I know if I drop like a Good Times reference or a Martin reference or a Living Single reference, and like people pick in
you don't think I get the Good Times reference?
I'm not saying I get the good times.
You should be the only one in the room who gets it.
But you know what I'm saying? It's just like I just know that there are just some advantages to, like I said, being able to go into different cities and just immediately having that sixth sense for like, oh, I know this restaurant is going to be good because I see who's in the kitchen, you know, like, or I know I feel comfortable in this neighborhood because I just I can sense it. I can feel it. It's just one of those things that, like I say, it comes with us preserving our own culture and having to be taught in our households to be aware of these things and be aware of these things and look for this, look for that. It helps, you know, it helps us navigate, and it kind of helps me also have a sense of place. I know that because I hold my culture near and dear that several other people do, and I'm not alone. So I can go into an all white space, but I know that like once I leave that all white space or if I leave any space where I'm the only black person, I'm not leaving my culture there behind me. Like I'm taking it with me everywhere I go. And I know that there are, I have that fellowship elsewhere. Like, okay, I'm going to be in this meeting and all, some of these things are going to go over my head, but that's fine. I'm just doing what I do, but I'm going to leave and still be whole. So that definitely helps.
I definitely feel like, kind of piggybacking off what you said, I definitely feel like a sense of pride. Just kind of like, I see other Black women doing amazing things, and then having just, you know, other Black women, my peers, complimenting me, like, I see what you did, you know, that's awesome, keep doing it. And it's just kind of like I said, a sense of pride where I'm that strong Black woman that I would see doing things, like, even when there's things against them, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to keep pushing forward, not that other races can't do it, but I just feel like it's just a strong sense of self, and this is who I am. And I see others supporting me while I'm supporting them. Just Black girl magic, simply.
I love being Black. I love everything about it now.
You might say it's dynamite.
Where's the bell? No, I do. Like,
this is the first time we've used this thing a lot on this show, but anyway.
I mean, I think there's so much to be proud of about it. I mean, yes, we have our issues and our challenges, and other people have no problem pointing out what those things are. But our art, our culture, like, we're the drivers of those things. You know, so much of what is, you know, origins of American music has their roots in Black culture. And so, like, as an art nerd, I am in love with that. I mean, and as a social movement activist, you know, we gave birth to so many other movements that used us as a blueprint for their movement. And so, yeah, I mean, we'll probably never get the credit. We'll be Little Richard till we die. We never get enough credit for what all we do. I started all of this. I'm the originator. But like, you know, but in so many ways we are. And so, yeah, it feels great to be part of that.
For me, perceptual advantages generally had to do around, I mean, again, yeah, okay, so there's the dancing thing. And I happen to like to dance. And when I was, I think it was like early 2000s when swing dancing came in, right? Swing dancing was, you know, a throwback to, you know, 1920s and, you know, yeah, I mean, all sorts of different types of dance back then. But I fell in love with it. And I had a natural ability for it that I didn't know. Until, you know, I started doing it and got a lot of trophies for swing dancing and everything. Even though it was considered a white thing, I'm like, oh, Black people pretty much invented this stuff. But when it became popular in early 2000, it was very, 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 yeah, very, very white, yeah. Cherry Pop and Daddies, all those people. The other one, of course, is, you know, obviously attached to dancing, rhythm. So then there's the sexual prowess thing. And so when I was dating, there were, you know, once you got into conversations around, and I won't comment on actual sex, but once you got into conversations leading to sex, there was always this assumption that I was just this sexual being who was going to ravish,
tear it up.
You know, no, just tear it, just tear it up, right? And but there was. And I,
you gonna learn today.
But maybe your Blackest show yet. Yeah, right.
But I mean, there was this assumption that was what was going to happen, and the hard part about navigating that, especially being open to dating more than just Black women, was the especially when it came to dating white women, there was the racial history I understood about arguments that Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, who, by the way, had a black wife. President of the Confederacy had a Black wife, but from the floor of the Senate, the same Senate floor that Barack Obama stood on, said all sorts of horrible things about Black people, one of them being, if we release our Black slaves, they will be given to crime, licentiousness, laziness, and they will rape our women and children. And so there is this kind of idea of the Mandingo that, you know, that Black men are super violent and super sexual, and Black women, of course, they had laws on the books up until the 50s or 60s where
could
if you
not
were,
be raped.
Yeah, you couldn't be raped, and if you were walking out past a certain time, you were going to get ticketed for prostitution, regardless. And so I think in a way, though, in date, you know, even if I didn't have that knowledge, if I didn't consider any of that, I would say the perceptual advantage of my racial identity was because I'm black, you know, I'm, you know, it's all swinging low and I can go for hours in bed. And so
I wish that there were some sort of saying or meme about once you have been with a black man, you don't return. I can't think of what it might. I don't know. Just go on with your story.
Yeah, I've heard that if, you know, once you go black, you're going to need a wheelchair. But that came from the movie White Chicks, and Terry Crews. It was so great in that movie. But anyway, he was just. Is he from Detroit? Terry Crews? He's from Flint. Yeah. Okay. But either way, that perceptual advantage worked out to a great degree in dating. And I wish it was something that I'm saying it worked out to a great degree in dating, and I'm only just kind of thinking that, and the person actually had another reason that I just am not aware of. These are things that were said to me. And so maybe not as crass as I'm putting it here, but for sure there was this idea that black men are more aggressive. That's why I want to date them. They're more aggressive than white guys. They're so passive. White guys are so passive. Black guys, they just tell me. And they just take what they want. I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Because I want you, I'm not going to deny it. But, you know, I want to deny it because that's so racist what you're saying to me right now. But
was that coming from a non-black woman?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this was never coming from a black woman. This is talking about the
black women know better.
Yeah. So, but it was a perceptual advantage. And if I didn't know any of that and I was just dating as a black guy, dating outside of my race, there's this idea of black men that we are sexually, you know, well endowed and very, very, you know, we know what we're doing in bed. And so that, I think, worked to my advantage in the dating world for a while.
See, I don't think of it as an advantage. It certainly happens in queer culture. White, I mean, you want to talk about white male sexual insecurity? No, that's okay. you know, like you really get that. You really get that in. You know,
that box away from you guys.
The dating apps for gay men, like in white gay guys, have no problems. Putting Mandingo fantasies up as part of what they think of as being a complementary social capital. The other part of this is that, like, how dangerous those beliefs were. Like, if we look at the drug laws that we have on the books that have incarcerated so many of black men, the roots of those drug laws were white males' anxiety about black men raping white women on coke.
Mm-hmm.
Or Asian men. Interestingly enough, like, we've desexualized Asian men now, but the argument against heroin and making that a drug law was that Asian men were gonna rape white women in California en masse because they were, like, outnumbering 10-1.
And they know karate, so we can't defend ourselves, right?
Right. Right. They're hyped up on heroin, sleeping with our women, and beating our butt. We have got to pass some laws.
I had a gun. He just took it out of my hand.
Exactly. Like, oh, okay. So, yeah, I think those things have been there. I mean, we touched on it, the rape of so many black women that wasn't legally considered rape. You know, so, yeah, it's out there, and people use it. And some people definitely take advantage of those stereotypes and have no problem, you know, getting laid as a result of them. Mm-hmm. But they've cost us. They've come at a price.
Absolutely. My wife and I have had some very difficult conversations. She's like, you know, we have a lot of conversations about race because there are things that she didn't know before she started dating me. And now she's very aware and very pro-black and obviously pro-husband. But she was like, you know, how did you feel leaning into this thing that you knew was racist, but because you were getting sex out of it, you were just silent on it? I was like, that kind of stuff ate away at me. I mean, it really did eat away at me. It was coming at a cost, as you were saying. It cost us something. Yeah, I'm getting sex in the short run, but in the long run, that person who I may never see again, or that person that I never ended up with in the first place, or in the long run, they now walk off with what I can only assume is continuing to perpetuate that idea. And so, or perpetuate other
racist
ideas.
There was a little
bit
of a compliment to self in that.
No, perpetuating the idea that it's okay to think racist things about about black people that may or may not be
I mean,
true about
also
the individual.
The objectification of it, yeah. of your body by that person. Like, you're not a human being. You're a thing that can get them off.
Yeah, see, in that respect, though, like,
you don't mind.
I didn't, because I was doing the same thing.
Right.
So, but when you add the racial thing to it, that makes it a little bit more difficult for me because of how pro-black I am. So it's.
I'm curious what the women have to say about this very male conversation about our prowess.
Yeah. Well, I was anyway. Give it to me. all right. So. Kent, last question. Go on with the last question. We'll move on from.
Yeah, okay. Got to find my notes. Okay. What are some concrete ways to rise above the negative aspects of racial identity while still clinging to the positive aspects of racial identity?
I definitely feel like that's just educating people, you know, explaining. You know, in a nice way, what it is that they're doing wrong, I guess. I've had plenty of people, like, you know, feel real comfortable. I work in Troy, and for some reason I just have this face that people want to talk to me, and I don't understand it. And
does she get a bell? Come on, man.
No.
Aww.
No.
You're pretty.
You know why?
You're pretty, that's why.
She has a face that I want to hear from.
No, you guys, I protest. It has nothing to do with her.
No, I don't come off very friendly at any point.
No, when I worked with her, like, it took me months to...
I'm very nice.
I'm still surprised she's here. I still think
really?
She hates me.
No, a little bit I do hate him, but...
Wow.
This is why we have a bell for you.
I know. That's all right.
But I don't appear as friendly. So when people cross the line, and especially with this election this past year, I don't understand why people feel so comfortable, because I'm not friendly. I'm very direct. And I just feel like I've had to check some people several times, make the whole store uncomfortable, because what they said was inappropriate. So I feel like the only way we can rise above that is by educating everybody, because apparently the one or two black people or minorities that they know aren't doing it. So since they felt safe enough to say it to a stranger, I feel like as a stranger, I need to let you know it's inappropriate. Don't do it again. Or if you're going to do it again, be ready, because I will leave this building and continue to educate you outside of my place of employment. So I feel like that's the only way to rise above it, is simply educating someone.
Would you like to step outside? I would not. I do not.
A viral Facebook video coming to a store.
Right. So, that's the only way you can do it. Don't be afraid to step on people's toes. I mean, there's always a way to say something so that you're not just downright disrespecting someone. But at the same time, if you don't do it, they're going to say it to someone else. If it's not corrected, it's going to continue. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I 100% agree with you. I think education is key. I don't know that... And people, you know, coming from the religious background that I come from, you know, people's hearts. I don't know that you're going to necessarily change people's hearts, but you can definitely educate people enough that you can make living around everybody else manageable, right? And I would obviously love to change people's hearts. I don't think legislation does that. You can't legislate morality. You can make – I think we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of a Supreme Court case that made it possible for my wife and I to be together. That didn't change people from being racist, but the law allowed us to – live as we want to live, right? You just had gay marriage passed for all 50 states by the Supreme Court as well. May not change people's hearts, but it definitely changed the law. So I think education is going to be key for people, and being willing to have those difficult conversations. I remember in college, someone asked me, how come the athletes in the lunchroom are so loud, right? Which was just code for black people. Why are the black people so loud? Like, they're loud because you're not part of their conversation. Because our table over here with mostly white people and me being the safe black guy is just as loud and has always been as loud and probably more rambunctious than that group of people over there. I think being willing to educate and say, here's why this, or if someone comes to you and asks you difficult questions, being willing to tell the truth rather than live in a space of creating more comfort for them when they need discomfort. So
when you said laws don't change hearts, but they can change society, because wouldn't it be safe to say that laws can change or forge the hearts of the next people, like the next generation?
Oh, absolutely.
Like in my case, I'm not so blind or unself-aware as to think that I don't have some racial prejudice. I think everybody, you know, but mostly unconscious. Mm-hmm. But I am not anywhere close to the level of racist that my parents or my grandparents or even my parents were, because I'm the benefit. I have the benefit of living in a society where the laws passed to shape that society, the laws that they saw passed, and I just accept as a reality.
Yeah.
So we change laws, and it doesn't change the hearts of the people Absolutely. We live with.
Yeah. So I mean, if I was going to use a recent case to say gay marriage has just passed, people dug in on both sides of that one. But I think my daughter's generation is going to, or maybe the generation after my daughter's, is going to grow up where this is the norm, where this is okay, where we figured out, you know, the legal ramifications and the societal ramifications for gay marriage in the United States. And it's just a thing like any other thing. So there, you know, that two generations from now, they'll be dealing with some other issue that the law will, you know, become the law of the land, and then it'll change the next generation's heart. I don't know. So I think it can be a impetus by changing society and making something normal, normalizing something. But I don't think laws necessarily change people's hearts in the beginning.
Yeah, I am not as hopeful, but I'm going to let her go first.
So
I said I hope. I don't know.
So a lot of times you don't have a law coming out of nowhere to right. that starts social
By the way,
change.
We've got 4 minutes left here.
Yeah, so you have a social movement, and then it grows momentum, and then a law comes along, and then that helps normalize it. But education is so huge. Like I just recently moved to Lansing, and I moved from a very rural community up north. And my favorite thing to do is to get invited to like redneck dinner parties because it was an opportunity. And so
but the food was great. I mean, it sounds good.
Not really.
No.
I did not know how to make potato salad. I'll just tell you that right now.
Well, it's German. It's German potato salad.
So it's coleslaw. Or sourkraut.
I have so many topics that are near and dear to my heart, like immigration, single moms, feminist theory, all kinds of things. And so I would get invited to these dinner parties, and it's a rural agricultural area, and they're like, oh, they took our jobs and yada yada. And I'm just like, you know what? Like I married a teacher, and we had some really tough times, and I've actually like talked my kids to sleep, like soothed them to sleep when there is no food in the house. When their bellies are eating their backbones, and that kills your soul. And if I were doing that daily in Guatemala or Honduras or Mexico or wherever, like, yeah, I would hop on a train. I would risk getting raped, murdered, so I could wash some, like, rich lady's toilet so that I don't ever have to do that ever again. And when you bring your story home, like Harvey Milk, when you come out and you say, like, hey, this is me. This is my story. This is real. I am human. That changes things. You know, so many times people would like put their Bud Light down. They're like, damn, I never thought about it like that before. I was like, yeah.
To be fair, I mean, whatever happened, what negative consequences have ever come from Germans with racial prejudice?
Oh, you're funny. Let me, because I know we're running out of time. So
yeah. Started.
Yeah.
I think for me, like I say, I'm a little bit more cynical about this because I'm seeing these things as cyclical. I don't see these things as a progressive move forward always. Like we're talking the same kind of language around Muslims as we did around Japanese internment. Toni Morrison gave a speech in like 74, 75 in which she essentially told black people, you know, there will always be one more thing. And I think the rise of Barack Obama should have killed respectability arguments forever. We will never give you anyone as accomplished, as smart, as perfect, as picture perfect as that family. And still they were called everything but a child of God. And so I think that for me says, for me to just worry about doing my work and worry about how can I take care of my community and worry about and spend my energies invested there. I have 42. I spent probably a good 15 or 20 of those years educating white people. There's Google. And there are allies like yourself and allies like Kent. And I feel like I'm passing that baton. Please go to those redneck dinners. Please y'all go educate
we can't do it no more. We're tired.
Like, too much emotional labor, right?
Too much emotional labor. Yeah. And like, so at this point, for me, it's about taking care of my own and doing the work. And if white folks, you know, appreciate it, yay. But it ain't about y'all for me right now.
I think the more I'll be quick. I was thinking about the SNL skit where there's Black Jeopardy.
Yay.
And there was one like right before the election where Tom Hanks.
Oh, that was a great one.
Like this very stereotypical hillbilly redneck, whatever you want to call it. But
Doug.
As he played the game, then people realized that. This culture had just as much in common with the black players than originally thought. Now, clearly,
what can a skinny girl do for you? Not a damn thing. Oh my God, I am. Yeah, that is absolutely correct.
Now, clearly, there is a Venn diagram drawn here.
Right.
It's not, one complete circle, but I think one of the ways that we could possibly, I'm just as cynical, but I am slightly optimistic. That once people, and when I say people, I'm really saying white people. Once people realize that there are many, many commonalities across the racial spectrum than we realize, then that can help sort of bridge some of these gaps. It will not happen in my lifetime. But that SNL skit, I feel like that should be like taught in a class or something like that, because that I was watching that and I was like, wow, this reminds me of Ypsilanti.
Yeah.
It was just where my dad's family is from. It's just like that conversation can literally happen in Ypsilanti at any time.
My favorite part of the sketch was the closing, and we'll say this in closing, but when he's like, the category came up, lives that matter. He's like, well, I got something to say about that. It's like, yeah, I'm sure you do. He's like, we'll see you guys next time. But thank you guys all so much for being here, guys and gals, for being here on the show. And thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, and a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. And tune in next week where Kent and I have invited on a group of diverse people to discuss the escalation of gun violence and the difficulty of enacting gun control legislation in America. See you next week.